Morning. We hear a lot about land move to development, but what about the other way around? Today we'll talk about how some Big Island private land is being reclaimed for public purposes. The Kohala Center's Kamana Beamer joins us, and we'll hear why Representative Carl Rhodes says he'll continue to press for prohibiting someone on the no-fly list from having a gun, even though the chair of the committee assigned to hear the bill has said he won't. I'm Beth Ann Koslovich.
And I'm Chris Vandercook. A box is more than just a box for master wood craftsman Michael Cullen, and he'll share a few of his secrets. And an orchid, as all orchid lovers know, is far more than just a flower. We'll look ahead to the Kauai Orchid and Art Festival and the Spring Fantasy Orchid Show on Kauai.
It's Thursday, March 24th. That's The Conversation coming up after this news.
Good morning and welcome to The Conversation. I'm Chris Vandercook. Good morning, Beth Ann.
Good morning.
Looking at the good a nonprofit can do, yeah?
And how it can inspire others in something more than just being able to have those nonprofits proliferate and do well. This goes to the heart of a lot of the conversations that we have about land. Now, we often hear that the loss of open space to private development is just a necessity of modern life. We also hear a familiar phrase in the nonprofit community about how one lead gift can inspire other donors. Both of those ideas come together in a program to reclaim private lands that were once parts of communities. It started with one land gift 18 months ago on Hawaii Island, which inspired another. Together, they became the Kohala Center's Aina Ho'i program and a potential model for other communities. Kohala Center President Kamana Beamer is on the phone with us now. Good morning.
Good morning, Beth Ann. Thank you so much for having me.
Well, I mean, this is a story that isn't just about the Kohala Center, but just looking at how we may be changing the way that we look at land. Do you see it that way?
Absolutely. You know, in Hawaii, we have this incredible history of building abundance off of our lands and this incredible system that fed, you know, hundreds of thousands of people. And we're really, in the midst of global climate change and the issues that we're facing locally and globally, we're seeing a movement that is going to allow us to return abundance to these lands.
Just to put everybody else in the picture, this started with one lead gift about 18 months ago. How did that happen?
You know, we have an incredible benefactor, Mr. Jim Posner. He was living in our Kohala Waimea community, and he decided he wanted to gift his incredible, most beautiful pieces of aina that you'll find to a local nonprofit. And he found out about our work at the Kohala Center and our mission and saw the way that we were servicing our community, and he approached us. And it literally changed our perception of what could happen and what's real.
The interesting thing is that he approached you. You'd never really thought about this before.
No, to be honest, we didn't know that it could happen, that it would be a reality. Mr. Posner kind of had a vision for this piece of aina to return and service the community, and he approached us, and, you know, we worked through all the legal issues and everything else there is in transferring land. But it's an incredible gift, and it really did spawn other efforts and other donors to hear about this incredible program, which is called Aina Ho'i.
After you had other donors join in, you began to formulate this as a whole program. Are other organizations looking to you to create a model that they might be able to replicate?
You know, we would love to help other communities find ways to, you know, there are some incredible work with them and to have lands be open and return to abundance. That's an incredible idea. And, the theme that we came up with to honor this gift and Mr. Posner was Aina Ho'i. It is indeed that which feeds us. We really envision these sites as sites for reflection.
I don't know whether we've just lost Kamana Beamer or not, but we seem to be having trouble with the phone line. We're going to try to get him back in a second there. But the idea that lands would be gifted to an organization, and not because the organization was seeking this, but because there may be a change in the way people are viewing their land and what it means to own something.
You do get the feeling from so many trends in the community that there has to be a change in the whole outlook that people have.
Well, that change may be evidence in what we're seeing here, but what that means for the state in general and whether there'll be other organizations that will be approached by other people too, because this is a little bit different than a land trust. I mean, this, and we're going to talk about that if we can get him back on the phone, looking at what that means for the communities and what this land will actually be used for, which may be very, very different from simply keeping big open space. Come on, are you there?
Yes, I am, Beth.
Oh,
thank
good.
You so much.
We were sorry to lose you. But as we were just talking about here while we were getting you back on the line, this looks very different from a land trust.
Yes, you know, we're building off of all that incredible work that's, you know, happened before us. But the real vision here for Aina Ho'i is to restore lands to abundance. And these will become sites for reflection on that which feeds us materially, spiritually, and culturally. And we allow us the opportunity to create transformational change in communities. So we'll be working hand in hand with communities to create abundance, to grow food, restore native food forests, restore sites for cultural practition. And it's an incredible opportunity and something that's really changing the way that we think about our island communities and the opportunities that surround us.
And changing the way that we regard productive lands.
Absolutely. I mean, like I had mentioned, we have this incredible history here in Hawaii about creating abundance on lands, and we need to be able to do that in the modern context. And the Kohala Center is working tirelessly to achieve that on these places, on these pieces of aina. And it, truthfully, they can become models for other places in Hawaii and in the world as to how we can work with community to restore our food systems and restore that community resilience.
What systems are you working on at the moment?
Oh, we have the gifted Niuli'i is this incredible parcel off the coast above Keokea Beach Park. And it has this incredible hala grove called Nahala o Naue, this historical forest where navigators going between Maui and Hawaii Island when they were lost, they could actually smell the hala grove.
Mm.
And we're working on coming up with a plan to restore some of this hala. There haven't been a lot of coastal hala restoration projects, and we're in the midst of figuring out how to seed and how to restore this hala forest. At the same time as we're mapping out a native food forest system, restoring ulu and plants that fed and thrived in these areas on a similar ag parcel.
Well, often we talk about the need to feed ourselves, but very often that comes with sort of a preconception of what that food should be. What you're really talking about is a return to foods that used to grow here that somehow fell out of favor with a lot of people after contact.
You know, that's true. And we're seeing globally this movement towards agroecological products. If you think about the last 10 years, the emergence of chia, of quinoa, of acai, there's a global market that wants to eat products and consume products that are grown in ways that align with social justice and the environment. And these crops for us here in Hawaii happen to be those kanu crops, crops that fed, you know, an abundance of people here on our islands and that are uniquely situated to adjust for the changes that we'll have in climate here in Hawaii.
Well, we wish you all the best with it, and we'll be checking in with you to see how those crops are going and how those communities are reclaiming and using these parcels of lands and possibly others that may come along. Thanks so much.
Thank you so much for the opportunity. Take care.
You too.
Aloha.
Aloha. Dr. Kamana Beamer is the President and Chief Executive Officer of the Kohala Center. The independent community-based Center for Research, Conservation, and Education is based in Waimea on Hawaii Island, where several gifts of private land will be used for public purposes. This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported HPR2. It's 8:13. Coming up, orchids and all their infinite variety. But first, your backyard quiz.
In today's backyard, we're shining a spotlight on a local talent who's earned national acclaim for her work in Avenue Q, Here Lies Love, and most recently, Lincoln Center Theater's revival of The King and I. Born in Arizona, she lived in Korea before moving to Honolulu, where she attended Jefferson and Kaahumanu Elementary Schools, along with Washington Intermediate. She's a 2001 graduate of Kaimuki High, who credits her involvement with the school's music and theater programs for helping her unleash her passion for the arts. In addition to acting, she plays the flute, ukulele, piano, accordion, and some clarinet. Her talent was recognized last year at the Tonys when she followed in the footsteps of Leah Salonga to become the second actress of Asian descent to win in the Best Actress category. Critics have given glowing reviews to her portrayal of Lady Thiang, and if you know who we've been describing, call 941-3689 or 1-877-941-3689 and be the first caller to name this mystery thespian and win an HPR t-shirt.
Hi, good morning. I'm Tony Gill from Honolulu. You're listening to The Conversation on HPR, Hawaii Public Radio. Join the conversation on Facebook at Hawaii Conversation.
All the beauty of nature is right there in the orchid, with their intricate design and almost infinite color palette, and the study and cultivation of these beautiful flowers have become a lifelong passion for thousands around the world. There's always much to learn about them, and the members of the Garden Isle Orchid Society meet year-round to share tips about what it takes for their flowers to thrive. As the Society prepares its annual Orchid and Art Festival, Ada Kuna is on the line to tell us about it. Good morning, Ada.
Hi, good morning.
You've been an orchid enthusiast for how long now?
Oh, for about 15 years.
What drew you into it?
Oh, I guess it's just the variety, the beauty, and the fact that they last so long, and the challenge of growing them.
What is the challenge, Ada?
Well, some orchids are made to be grown up in higher climates. I live right by the sea, and certain orchids won't grow well here.
Yeah.
So they're kind of temperamental.
You've got salt air to deal with where you live then,
yes,
huh?
Yes.
Well, but that's, that takes a hardier variety of plant. But some orchids are quite hardy, aren't they?
Yes, there are. Well, remember that orchids originally grew in trees, and they would be blown from one tree to the next, and then that's how they were spread out through, say, South America.
Well, you know, Ada, other flowers are beautiful, right? But orchid fanciers seem to have a kind of a separate world of their own, that there's something...
Absolutely.
Why
well,
is that?
Well, there are 30,000 species and 800 genera. And a lot of our growers are creating new types of orchids. They'll crossbreed of certain orchids. So there's the challenge. You know, there was an orchid fever, a couple hundred years ago in England, where people would kill for a certain orchid.
Really?
They've some wealthy Englishmen would send people down to, say, the jungles in South America and look for orchids. And when they'd find a certain species and they had enough to ship back to England, they would destroy the rest of them, and so no one else could have that species.
Well, that's not very ecumenical spirit,
no.
is it?
But it was very interesting. And there are just so many things to learn about the orchids. I mean, for instance, orchids have to have, insects to fertilize them. And there are some orchids that if they don't have the insects, they have like a certain sexual attraction to bring the insects to them to breed them.
So
they're just a very interesting plant.
Well, so you not only need the right soil and the right temperature and the right kind of atmosphere conditions,
right.
but you need bugs too, huh?
Yeah, you gotta fertilize them.
Where do you get your bugs?
A lot of our people use a toothpick and they'll take the pollen from one and put it on another, and that's how they breed them.
Uh huh. Oh, so you take the place of the insects that aren't endemic to the area?
That's right.
So I'm assuming that not all these orchids are native species, but are some of them?
No, we only have three native species.
Uh-huh.
They're terrestrial. They grow in the ground. And recently I read where the botanical gardens here on Kauai had planted some up in the Alakai Swamp. I don't know. I haven't heard how they're doing.
Well,
but
if they...
there are other orchids that... like the bamboo orchid that came from the Philippines that is growing wild here.
Mm-hmm.
But there are only three native Hawaiian species. It's just to bring them here naturally is just impossible because we're so isolated.
Well, the world of orchid cultivation has a lot to do with cross, what you were describing as crossbreeding,
yes, uh-huh.
yeah?
Yeah, you'll see a flower that looks like a cattleya, but it when you look at the name, it says Brassea lilea cattleya. That means it's been crossed three times with three different types of cattleyas.
So it seems as if there's almost no limit even to what could yet be done in
Absolutely,
terms of,
yeah.
So every orchid grower has the potential to kind
right.
of...
Right. But most of our orchids were brought in from... sailors when they came into the islands, and they left them behind. And it used to be a rich man's game, but now everybody can do it.
Well, that's refreshing, huh?
Yeah.
They transported in what form? Just in seeds or a bulb?
They would bring them in by boat.
But I mean as a full-grown plant? Or?
Yes, as a plant, yeah.
And then they get cross-fertilized. I'm thinking that you then put them in an environment where they don't have the insects.
Yeah, right. Then the growers that have to fertilize them.
But they are most of them are dependent on some sort of other organism to
right.
cross-pollinate them.
Right.
Huh?
Yeah.
That would seem to make them kind of a delicate species. Haven't
yeah,
it?
Absolutely. Yeah.
And yet they come from...
In Hawaii, mainly, we had the Vandas, the Phalaenopsis, and Dendrobiums. But now with the Internet, our guys are always looking for new types that'll grow here. So I think we'll have about 30 different types of orchids at the orchid show.
And have some of your members created, new...
Yes. They've crossbred them, and we have one young lady that crossbreeds her dendrobiums. And, of course, the thing is that you don't know for several years when the orchid blooms what it's going to look like. It could be really ugly, but they some of them have a talent for knowing which flowers you can crossbreed.
I've never seen an orchid I would describe as ugly, but I guess they're relative terms, right?
Well, there's some, the colors don't come out as pretty as they want.
Yeah. One of the things I think that makes them spectacular, and I was looking at some on your Garden Isle Orchid Society website, are just not just the richness of the color, but the very, very subtle kind of gradations of color, the way they blend into each other. Yeah?
Right. Yeah, for many years I photographed the winners of the orchid show, and I also did some photography for one of the growers, and it was so amazing. I have one hanging on my wall here, and it's so amazing how many subtle colors there are.
Yeah, is that something that is sort of particularly true of orchids, do you think?
Well, of course, roses have it too, but orchids I think are just special.
Well, like roses, orchids have their passionate devotees, don't they,
yeah.
Ada? Of which you are one.
Well, you know the orchids is the largest plant family in the world.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah.
Well, we'll look forward to that show, Ada. Thanks very much for talking
with
us.
Well, yeah, we look forward to people coming. There are a lot of people that, you know, snowbirds that come, and they'll set their schedules so that they can see the orchid show before they leave.
I can see why.
Yeah.
Thanks a lot, Ada. Ada Kuna is the publicity director for the Garden Isle Orchid Society, whose annual Orchid Society Spring Fantasy Show will be held Friday and Saturday, April 1st and 2nd, in Hanapepe Town at the United Church of Christ. It's free and open to the public. It coincides with the 10th consecutive Kauai Orchid and Art Festival in Hanapepe Town that will include art all over town with an orchid theme.
Justice delayed for a crime that can never be denied.
I don't think you could ever say it ends an era or closes an arc in the scale of the killing during these wars.
Finally, a verdict for former Bosnian Serb president Radovan Karadzic. That's next time on The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International.
This morning at 9, right after The Conversation.
You love Hawaii Public Radio. You listen all the time. You are a true radiophile. Mahalo to these radiophiles for their recent gifts. Catherine Clark of Lake George, New York, Doug Miller of Wailuku, and Cynthia Fite of Kaneohe. Signal the depth of your feeling for HPR with a personal gift of support. Early initiative on your part can mean fewer fundraising interruptions in the future. Call us at 955-8821 during business hours or give online at hawaiipublicradio.org. Thanks.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Bronster Fujichaku Robbins, a civil litigation law firm handling major cases on all islands for clients of all sizes, from individuals to Fortune 500 corporations. BFRHawaii.com.
Once he was a rising star among Hawaii Democrats, then last year, Hawaii Island Mayor Billy Kanoi made headlines after he charged thousands in personal expenses on his county credit card. Now, after a year's investigation by the Attorney General, a grand jury has indicted Mayor Kanoi. Civil Beat reporter Chad Blair has the details in today's Reality Check. Good morning.
Good morning, Beth Ann.
Well, this is a story that, in when it first became known, took a lot of people by surprise because, you know, Mayor Kanoi had been seen as someone who was really going places in the party, and this seemed to stop him in his tracks for a little while, and then the story disappeared, and now we have this indictment.
It's a serious indictment, 2 felony counts, 2 misdemeanor theft charges, tampering with government records, lying under oath. If he is convicted on all of those counts, it would be thousands of dollars in fines and several years in jail. Now, let me just clarify, this is an indictment. It is not. That means a finding of probable cause, but it is by no means a criminal conviction. But it is a very serious matter. And remember, this all stems from the governor's, speaking of his possible future, it did seem like Mayor Kanoi could run for governor or Congress. But in fact, he has said he's going to step down from politics. But let me just clarify here, this all stems from Kanoi's use of his county-issued credit card, his P card, for unauthorized expenses.
And some of those expenses included at a hostess bar.
Yes, 2 hostess bars, actually, here in Honolulu. There's a surfboard on there, about $1,200 or something, trips abroad. Now, it totaled about $130,000. The mayor has paid that back. There is no outstanding obligation to the county. But should the mayor have been using a county-issued credit card for his own personal expenses? And that's really what is at stake here.
As well as for those coming after him who might be well warned that that's not a blank check.
Exactly. Now, his lawyer is stressing that what Kanoy has done is it's noncompliance with a credit card, but it's not actually a crime, that he doesn't have anything to hide. Everything's been transparent. He says there's not a penny owed to the county. We've heard some news reports that the mayor himself will be making a statement later today. But it's interesting, as the indictment was coming down yesterday, he was being filmed by Big Island Video News talking about how you should never disrespect the county, that he didn't take anything. You can actually watch that video not only at Big Island Video News, but we have it on our website as well. Very interesting timing coming out at the exact same time the indictment is going down.
Exactly. And although, as you've made the point that this is an indictment, we will wait and see whether it turns into a criminal conviction. As the AG's office has noted, it's not yet, and we shouldn't presume anything. But this is looking pretty damning.
It is. And remember, the mayor has apologized repeatedly. He is term limited. His seat is up this year. And there's already, last time I checked, 7 or 8 people or more had pulled papers to run for that seat, including his former boss, Mayor Harry Kim, a few others, Wally Lau, I think the former managing director there. So it's going to be a very competitive race. But this shadow cast over it by the fall thus far, it seems, of Mayor Billy Kanoy.
All right. Thanks so much, Chad. Sad story in a lot of ways. We'll talk more tomorrow and see what he has to say, possibly later today. Chad Blair joins us every day for a reality check from Civil Beat.
Good morning. At 8:30, you're tuned to The Conversation on Statewide, member-supported HPR2. I'm Chris Vandercook. You can reach us here at Hawaii Public Radio in several different ways. Our talkback line is 808-792-8217. We're on Facebook at Hawaii Conversation or on Twitter at HI Conversation. You can email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. Coming up later, finding the soul in a piece of wood. But first, the news from Deutsche Welle.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from First Insurance Company of Hawaii, providers of auto, home, commercial, and specialty lines of insurance since 1911. First Insurance Company of Hawaii, FICOH.com.
Tonight at 5, Bethany will be bringing us Town Square and looking at prescriptive authority for psychologists. This is an issue that's been around for a while.
You bet, and it's been a long and contentious one for doctors and for psychologists. I mean, there isn't a total agreement on either side, mm-hmm. and nor really is this just a matter of a sort of a turf battle.
And yet in mental health care, prescriptions are used a great deal, right?
And that's part of the point, especially when we've got a doctor shortage and when you're talking in more rural areas, what does that mean for people there? Then again, there are some who say, but if you're only going to a psychiatrist for prescriptions, maybe that's a reason for, psychologists to be able to do that. But the psychiatrists are saying, wait a minute, this is more than just being able to write what you think might be good. There's a lot more that they believe that psychologists should know and that they themselves, psychiatrists, know. And we're going to hear from both sides tonight, but very clearly this is not going to end anytime soon.
Well, one of the things that anyone who prescribes needs to know is the whole issue of drug interactions, which is, as more and more prescriptions multiply, becomes a greater issue, yeah?
And some doctors have said, we don't get all that much training in pharmacopoeia when we're in medical school. Others get more. You can choose to take more, but what that means and who's drawing what lines and for what reasons is a part of what we're going to be exploring tonight. There are, as I say, good reasons on both sides and not so good reasons that others are talking about, too, as we look at the whole idea of who should have prescriptive authority when it comes to psychologists.
And, of course, a lot of people affected by this.
Well, a lot of people who don't have access, to medical care of all sorts, and that's been part of the big reasons. But we've seen that in lots of other cases, too, not just with psychologists and psychiatrists, but generally speaking, because we've got a doctor shortage.
Well, we'll look forward to it. That's tonight at 5 on Town Square. Thanks, Bethan.
In every legislative session, there are surprises. On Tuesday, the State Senate Public Safety, Intergovernmental, and Military Affairs Committee deferred a House bill that would have temporarily stopped someone on the FBI's watch list from the Terrorist Screening Center from having a gun. The measure was introduced by Representative Carl Rhodes, who says he still thinks Hawaii needs the measure and that he'll pursue it into the next session. Representative Rhodes joins us now by phone. Good morning.
Good morning, Beth Ann.
Why did you think Hawaii needed this measure now?
Well, I think there's been a national movement to been looking at loopholes in gun control laws, and this was one that came to my attention fairly recently. I had always assumed that we would not authorize the sale of a firearm to someone on the terrorism watch list, but as it turns out, when we did the research this summer, my assumption was wrong, and we do allow it.
Don't first-time buyers, though, have to be fingerprinted by the FBI?
They do, and there is a background check done, and even though the information in that background check would indicate whether or not you're on a terrorism watch list, the police would have no legal basis for denying you a firearm.
Even though that person might be on the watch list?
Even though they're on the watch list, for sure. The police can see that information, but they would have no, under Hawaii law, they would have no legal basis for denying the purchase of the weapon.
Now, most people think that we have wonderful gun laws in Hawaii. In fact, last year, the Law Center to Prevent Gun Violence ranked Hawaii in the top 10. But you're saying that this loophole exists and the only way around it is legislation.
That's essentially what I'm saying. I mean, we do have very strict gun control laws. We have very low gun violence rates. In fact, I think we're number one in the country. That's a combination of several things. Part of it is attitude. We don't just start shooting each other for, you know, because we're having an argument. It's also because we have strict gun control laws. It's also because we're geographically isolated. So I lived in the District of Columbia 25 years ago when it was murder capital of the world, and D.C. had very tight gun control laws, tighter than what we have here. But you could cross the Potomac River to Virginia, which had virtually no gun control laws, and you could bring weapons in. So, yeah, we do have strict gun control laws, and this bill is just filling what I view as a small but fairly important puka.
How many other states have similar legislation?
Only two. Actually, only one has legislation. New Jersey has a bill that they passed about 3 years ago, and Connecticut just recently, November, December of 2015, instituted the denial if you're on the suspected terrorist list by executive order.
So when you talk to the chair of the Public Safety, Intergovernmental, and Military Affairs Committee, did you get any answers to why he and his committee won't hear this bill?
Oh, they did hear it. I haven't talked to him since then, and I don't know why he deferred it.
There was no reason given at all?
I haven't talked to him. I was sick this week, and I have. And this, yesterday was a deadline, and I just haven't had a chance to talk to him. So I'm sure he has his reasons. I don't know what they are at this point.
Is there any chance in your mind that this might be resurrected this time around, or were you really looking toward next session?
I don't think it's going to, because there was a Senate version of the bill too, and PSM never even heard that one. So you know, theoretically, you could put it in another bill, but then you'd muddy the waters with. There are four other gun control bills that are still alive, having to do with the not giving guns to stalkers, not giving guns to the mentally ill, not allowing people who are intoxicated to have them in public, and then there's another one that has to do with checking to see whether somebody who's applied for a gun and gotten it has subsequently committed a felony outside the jurisdiction where they got the gun. So theoretically, you could slide it into one of those others. The title would probably be big enough, but I'm not going to try to do it just because it muddies the water on what I view as other important loopholes that we need to fix.
So at this point, do you really sense that maybe there's just not an appetite for a measure of this sort?
Well, I don't think so. It passed the House fairly easily. I mean, there were no votes, but you know, it passed the House in a full floor vote. If you look at the public side, you know, outside the building, the Star Advertiser did an unscientific poll where 86% of the people said yes. Who in their right mind would give guns to terror suspects? And if you And this mirrored national results of scientific polls, where 83% of people said that people on the terrorism watch list shouldn't be sold guns, and even 77% of Republicans agreed with that. So, you know, there is an appetite for it. I think the appetite is probably strengthened by what happened the same day that the bill was deferred in Belgium. You know, there, I consider myself a liberal, and but the threat of terrorism in Hawaii is not zero. It's you're more likely to die of secondhand smoke or be in a car crash, but you know, we have a way to reduce the risk of harm done by a potential terrorist in Hawaii, and we need to take it.
Given all that you said about the appetite for a measure like this in other places and just nationally, why do you think then there are so few states which actually have one?
Well, I think part of it is a deference to the federal government on this issue, because there is a national security aspect of it, and it's, you know, there's always this difficult line that you try to walk between civil liberties and national security, and I think most states would prefer to just let the feds do it, but as most of us are aware, the federal government is in the throes of a partisan gridlock, and nothing's happening there, and, you know, in the meantime, the General Accountability Office of the U.S. Congress, which is their investigative arm, they did an investigation on people on the suspected terrorism list trying to purchase guns, and they said it happened 2,233 times, an attempted purchase. There were 2,233 attempted purchases, and 91% of the time they were successful. So the states start looking at that and say, you know, if the feds aren't going to do anything, then maybe we ought to.
But in Hawaii, given the fact that you said a little while ago, you know, you may have a higher chance of dying from secondhand smoke, is that the kind of reason that someone would use to say, well, we just really don't need to have one more bill about this going through?
Well, I don't think so. I think the dying of secondhand smoke is always a higher, all across the country and probably almost all of the world, you're more likely to die of secondhand smoke than you are to die of a terrorist attack. I mean, even 9/11, the year of 9/11, approximately 3,000 people died in that terrorist attack. That same year, 30,000 people died from gunshot wounds in the United States, and another 130,000 were injured. So, you know, relative. Exotic risks are always exotic risks are ones that we focus on more, but usually it's the prosaic ones that get you in the end. So I'm not suggesting that this is that HB 1813 is what am I trying to say? It probably won't affect very many people, but I do believe it's a prudent measure for minimizing the risk of terrorism, which is not zero.
All right. As we've seen, that certainly is the case. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Representative Carl Rhodes joins us this morning to talk about HB 1815. 13.
Next time on the New Yorker Radio Hour, Brian Stevenson, an activist who says we still haven't come to terms with the legacy of slavery in this country.
The great evil of American slavery was not involuntary servitude and forced labor. I think the great evil of American slavery was the ideology of white supremacy.
Brian Stevenson. And we'll hear from one of the founders of Instagram about that app's chaotic launch. That's next time on the New Yorker Radio Hour.
Friday evening at 7.
Good morning. I'm Jiang Jinlu from Hawaii University Law School, a visiting scholar from China King & Wood Mallison Law Firm. You are listening to the conversation on HPR2, member-supported Hawaii Public Radio.
And earlier this morning, we asked you to name the local expat who picked up some impressive hardware last year when she took home the Tony for Best Actress in a Featured Role in a Musical. Critics have glowingly noted that her interpretation of Lady Tiang in the revival of The King and I resonated with sensitivity, warmth, and empathy. This 2001 graduate of Kaimuki High School credits music teacher Daryl Liu, theater teacher Peggy Ann Sigmund, and band teacher Keith Higaki, as well as career counselor Lei Kudo, for nurturing her passion for the arts. Over a decade later, her impressive resume includes touring the U.S. with Sweeney Todd in Annie and playing various characters in Avenue Q and portraying Imelda Marcus in the off-Broadway musical Here Lies Love. And if you can't catch her on stage, rising star Ruthie Ann Miles can be seen on the small screen. She's slated to have a recurring guest role this season on the FX series The Americans. It's now 8:47. That's today's quiz. If you've got one for us, send it in to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for the Backyard Quiz comes from the College of Business at Hawaii Pacific University, whose MBA Flex Plus program offers a blend of classroom and online classes to fit the lives of working professionals. hpu.edu/business.
It takes a certain temperament and a formidable set of skills to become a master wood craftsman. You need a great deal of patience, a flair for precise detail, and an appreciation for the beauty and the personality of a piece of wood. Michael Cullen has become a kind of an ambassador for woodcraft, which he learned as an apprentice after studying mechanical engineering. He's in Hawaii for a series of workshops, and he's on the line with us this morning. Good morning, Michael.
Good morning, Chris.
I'm intrigued that you started out as a mechanical engineer. What led to that switch?
I was always doing woodworking already as a kid and also art. And so when I was studying as a mechanical engineer, I was, you know, building the furniture for my house or for my apartment at that time and also taking art classes. And then at some point, after I graduated and started working as an engineer, I continued with my art, and then it just essentially kind of took over my life, and I decided to really pursue my passion.
Were you able to apply the principles of one to the other?
Oh, absolutely, and stuff, and that's why I was looking for a bridge, and I had never really thought about furniture, but I'd seen the work of a couple of very established furniture makers, mm-hmm. artists at that time. And so that bridge became because I was doing mainly sculpture at that point,
yeah.
and seeing this type of art furniture that was being made, it was a way for me to bring both my interest in engineering and art together. It was a bridge.
Well, because in sculpture, you don't have to think about things like the load it will bear or, the structural integrity, that kind of thing, right?
Well, most of the time. I mean, I don't know if I think that, if it is some kind of, a structural large piece. I'm actually doing a public sculpture when I return to the mainland for Lagunitas Brewing Company, which will go out in front of their main brewery. And you definitely have to think about structural things and how things are going to work, how the public's going to interact with it.
Mm-hmm.
So that's where the engineering does come in handy. So,
but when you're making a chair, somebody's going to sit in it. When you make a table, people are going to put things on it. And, a little bit more in terms of practical application to be considered, yeah?
Absolutely, especially with a chair and stuff. You have to really, there's a lot of engineering in a chair, a lot. So, especially if you want it to be light and you want it to look good and you want it to just definitely be structurally sound.
Some of the people I've talked to who work with wood, and a lot of them being luthiers, makers of guitars and ukuleles, talk about wood in terms of it having an almost still living quality. Do you feel that a little bit?
I know where they're coming from.
Yeah.
That and stuff. I mean, that's a very, very different field. And I think for myself, I was trained on the East Coast, and it's a very, very formal atmosphere back there. And so when I returned back to California after, you know, being back there for quite a few years, all of a sudden I had this, you know, very formal training. But being in Northern California, it was a bit of a fish out of water. People were using local woods, and things were a lot looser. Mm-hmm. And so what I ended up embracing eventually in some of my work was the idea that I wouldn't remove the tree from the wood. And so it's kind of a similar type thing, so that you would see some kind of evidence of this this material that was once living.
Yeah.
So.
Well, I think there is a relationship there that's not quite as mystical as some can get about wood, but there is that different quality that wood has. Yeah?
Oh, absolutely. I think that's what differentiates it from, you know, glass is a natural material too, but you don't look at it and say, wow, that was once on a beach.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And the same thing with metal and stuff. It doesn't matter, you know, sheet after sheet. Now I'm probably getting myself in trouble, but, you know, if you pick up a piece of bar stock and stuff, it's going to look like any other piece of bar stock. But with wood, because it was living at one time and living in a particular place with, you know, very, very different conditions from another tree that mm-hmm. might just be a mile away, each board you pick up is going to have evidence of that life.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that certainly seems to me to be part of the whole fascination.
Absolutely. Yeah, definitely.
Your career, in some ways, you talked about that East Coast atmosphere, and it strikes me that the East Coast is perhaps a little bit more linked to the whole notion of apprenticeship as it was done almost going back to the 19th century. That it looks as if a lot of your career, you were actually an apprentice in a very old school kind of way. Is that accurate?
That's very accurate. And I went into it with a, you know, very romantic idea that I was going to be, you know, making furniture and working with my hands. And what it turned out to be, which would have been very different had I stayed in California to go, you know, pursue furniture. Being on the East Coast, I was trained by an Englishman who'd come out of the Barnsley shops, which was the kind of premier workshops that was established during the arts and crafts area in the late 19th century.
Mm-hmm.
And so my training was very, very rigorous and very old style. So it was pretty much like what you would get out of an English apprenticeship or what we think of. You know,
well, in that makes you pretty lucky in a lot of ways, right? You really got a lot of the because these are traditions that go back hundreds of years, and there's no hurrying this kind of work, is there?
I thought I was very, very lucky, and I think with all the crafts and what I saw evidence of yesterday when I went up to visit the University of Hawaii, just looking at the ceramics that were. The ceramic pieces that were outside the department, it was like, wow, they teach foundation here at the university.
Mm-hmm.
And I've always been a big believer in foundation. And for the basic reason is that once you have training, then you have the ability to do anything. So you might do it slowly, but you have the kind of the basic components so that you can attack any problem and build on that. And so then you can worry about things like your self-expression or your signature or your design. But you have that, you know, the basic training that you really need.
Well, you know, technique's not a prison. It's a liberator, right? It opens up your imagination to acquire.
Well, yeah, absolutely. But anything can be a prison and stuff because you can, you know, once you have that, you can stay at that point and you know, you can end up going down the route of perfection, you know, where you're just always looking for perfect work, and you don't end up with much from that.
Yeah, that could drive. That's a good way to drive yourself crazy, Michael. But you seem to have eluded that. Thanks very much for talking with us.
You bet, and thank you for calling this morning.
Sure. Michael Cullen is a master wood craftsman from Petaluma, California, who give an artist talk on Thursday, March 31st at the Donkey Mill Arts Center on Hawaii Island. He's also giving Art of the Box workshops tonight through Saturday at the University of Hawaii and next Friday at Tai Lake Fine Woodworking in Holualoa on Hawaii Island. You can find more about him on our Hawaii Conversation Facebook page.
Aloha, I'm Derek Malama, and on the next Kanikapila Sunday, you'll hear music from the new album by Hoku Zudemeister, which doesn't hit the stores until April, plus songs from Raiatea Helm, the Brothers Casimero, Amy Hanaili'i, lead duo Kupawa, and Nathan Aveau. And the Kanikapila Sunday Classic. Please join me for Kanikapila Sunday from 1 to 4 p.m.
Bethann, we can be grateful that Hawaii has tight gun control laws, but as Representative Rhodes pointed out, it only takes one incident to change the whole climate, yeah?
And sometimes we forget that because we want to look at the law of probability.
Right.
And that's a good thing, especially when you have a lot of measures moving through. But with this one, it'll be interesting to see whether that will change, even though we know that it can only take one time, as we clearly have been seeing in the last several years.
Yeah, exactly.
That's going to do it for us for this morning, but coming up tomorrow, women entering the workplace get some help to know exactly what they're going to face. Susan Wurzburg, UH lecturer and online professor, will join us.
And there's an art show at the Holman Museum of Art about the contact between cultures.
We like to hear from you, and you can get to us anytime you like. Just call our talkback line, 808-792-8217, or you can email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. We're on Facebook at Hawaii Conversation, or you can tweet us at HI Conversation or at BKOZHPR.
And if you missed any of this show or want a past one, you can find them on the Conversation page on hawaiipublicradio.org. I'm Chris Vandercook.
I'm Bethann Kozlovich. We'll see you in the morning for more of The Conversation.